Today is Thursday, August 29th. We are working on chemistry, starting on page 22. We left off talking about lipids in our last class period, so today we're going to start off with proteins. Like I mentioned, if you're making flashcards, some good things to put on there are building blocks or monomer, functions, any specific examples. Those are good things to kind of get you started with learning this content. So when we talk about the proteins, the amino acids are the building blocks for this category. In fact, there's 20 different kinds of amino acids. So in different combinations, they will build for us different kinds of proteins. Okay, so proteins provide structure. They do play very important functional roles. And I wanted to take a moment to talk you through some of those structural and functional proteins on your worksheet. Some structural proteins make components of cells and tissues. You know, we will talk about protein, integral proteins, peripheral proteins today. And throughout this course in Bio 211, we'll also talk about different functional proteins. You'll notice some on the list there include hormones, buffers for pH balance. You'll notice also enzymes, and even defense proteins. You know, we consider fingernails to be defensive proteins. Without them, then, you know, we don't have the claws that other animals have for defense. So a lot of different purposes there to have proteins in our bodies. This is covalently bonded atoms. How do you know this picture shows covalent bonding? Single lines, good. And are these single, double, or triple covalent bonds? Yeah, some doubles, some singles. And if you're looking at a double covalent bond, how many pairs of electrons are shared there? Two pairs, good. So if you're doing pairs, you're thinking, what, four total electrons? So there's a lot of covalent bonding holding these amino acids together. In fact, there's a pretty strong bond holding these amino acids together, and it's called a peptide bond. You'll notice the peptide bond is colored purple up here, and it's made up of our top four elements: oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen. So when you hear about pep anything, pepsin, peptide, polypeptide, pep is a code word meaning what?
Protein,
right. So you're going to hear about pep this and pep that throughout this course, and especially in the Bio 211, pep means protein. Gives new thoughts to the meaning pep rally, right? It's not a protein rally, but here it would make us think that. What you're looking at is called a dipeptide. What does that prefix di tell us?
Two.
So most proteins are a little more complicated than that. Most proteins have more than two amino acids forming them. Most proteins are more complex, like you see here. This is a polypeptide. Poly meaning what?
Many.
Yeah, so each individual bead on this string is in fact an amino acid. There's lots and lots of them joined together through peptide bonding. There's that word again, peptide. And what we have here is an incredibly long protein. Another name for a really big long protein is polypeptide. Or you could simply say it's a macromolecule. What does macromolecule tell us? Big molecule, yeah. So I make the point about proteins being large molecules because when you eat a protein, it takes a lot to digest a protein. You have to break apart each one of these amino acids from its neighbor, and so that can take a very long time. If you've noticed, when you eat a protein-rich meal, whether it's meat or eggs, even tofu, rice and beans are also protein-rich, you tend to stay full longer and you tend to stay satisfied longer. If you eat a meal that's rich in carbs, hey, give it an hour. I'm looking for something, right? You're looking for something else to fill up your belly because that carb is very easy to break down. Not the case with proteins. They're actually much bigger. They're much more difficult to break down because there's lots of amino acids linked together here. So in terms of protein structure at the very bottom of your page, proteins will come from a primary structure like you see here. This is what we call beads on a string appearance. It literally looks like a string of pearls or a string of beads, and proteins will first assemble themselves into this structure. Then they will take on a more complicated structure. From the bead-like appearance on the top here, they go to what's called secondary structure. Secondary structure involves an alpha helix, which looks kind of like a curl over here, or sometimes they'll take on what's called a beta pleated sheet. Basically, this is a protein getting into its most complex state. Proteins will then form a third level structure called a tertiary structure. See, the blue portion makes up these individual parts. And then the most complex protein structure is quaternary level structure. And so this may not look like a whole lot to us. It just looks like ribbons or maybe a string of necklace all twisted up in some particular shape. But in fact, what this is doing is it's building a very important protein like hemoglobin. Do you know where hemoglobin's found? In your blood. So to me, this looks like reddish orange and pinkish purple twist. You know, to you and me, this is like, okay, so what? It's a bunch of twisty stuff. To the hemoglobin molecule, this is very important because there are little portions here where oxygen binds and is traveling. So if we rearrange the way this protein is structured, then we make this protein unfunctional. It can't work if you rearrange the structure. So to give you kind of something to think about the way a car is structured. For you to ride in the car, you've got to have seats, right? If you take the seats out of your car, you take the gas pedal, the brake pedal, the steering wheel out of your car, can you ride in your car? It'd be pretty hard, right? Unless you're Fred Flintstone with your feet on the bottom. So that's the case here with this protein. If you rearrange the seats for the oxygen molecules, then oxygen cannot take a ride on the hemoglobin. So like I mentioned, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, but to a protein, these levels of structure are everything about the way that protein works. So it goes from primary to secondary to a third level called tertiary to the very most complicated, which is in fact polypeptides hooked together. What is the fourth level called? Quaternary, right. So one, two, three, four complicated levels of twisting and structure makes up most of our proteins. All right, so that's just a little bit of intro about proteins. How about questions on page 22? I'd like to spend a moment with you on enzymes. They're actually on page 23. And to talk about enzymes, let's talk about a term called metabolism. We've heard of catabolism and anabolism. Those are building and breakdown reactions, but in fact, they're part of a bigger picture called metabolism. How would you define metabolism? Good. Some of all chemical reactions that occur in the body. Do you know if your metabolism is working? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You will know if your metabolism's not working because you will feel awful, right? So drained, yeah, like you just can't get any energy to go. So, you know, when you are running on empty, you're exhausted, you have stress in your life, you haven't eaten properly, you know how you feel like you're just going to die? Your metabolism's off whack, right? Is that every day? That's every day for me. But yeah, if you feel like you're just drained and you're not running on full, then your metabolism may not be working all those chemical reactions properly. You know how you feel when you're coming down with an illness? You feel like you just need to crawl in the bed and stay there forever? That is metabolism not working properly. And a lot of what helps our metabolism run is enzymes, which are actually a special kind of protein. So you'll notice in this picture here, these enzymes and substrates, in other words, the chemical that they're working with, are going to work closely together because of the way they fit together. You have a key for your house, right? You can't open your neighbor's house, most likely, with that same key. And they can't open yours. And that's how enzymes work. They work like a lock and key fit with only one type of substrate, meaning they only can do chemical reactions on one type of chemical. So most enzymes have an ending of A-S-E. And so when you hear about lactase, that's an enzyme that works on a sugar called lactose. Something else you'll want to notice about these enzymes, they seem to have a pretty special location for the enzyme and the substrate to fit together. What do we call that special location where they fit? Active site. Good. So believe it or not, you're looking at a quaternary level type protein here, something that's really complex in its shape and structure. And if you were to change the shape of your enzyme, and that were to change the shape of your active site, could your enzyme work on your substrate anymore? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's really important that our enzymes are happy in your body, meaning they're at homeostasis with your surroundings. Otherwise, we may not be able to get our enzymes to work properly. We talked about this term activation energy back in earlier part of chapter 2, and it means the amount of energy to make a reaction run. What kinds of reactions require an input of energy? Anabolic and endergonic. Good. So endergonic technically means energy is required for the reaction to run, and anabolic reactions are what type? Building. Right. So building reactions require energy to be put in. I want to talk to you about this picture again, because what enzymes do is they help to make sure that your energy is spent in other places and not all just to make a reaction run. So we say that enzymes lower the activation energy, meaning they make it easier for your metabolic reactions to actually start off and run. So I'd like to show you a video. I'm going to switch computers here for a moment. I love how YouTube will play ahead and ahead, and we don't want that one. There we go. Okay, so if you would like to see this one, just go on YouTube and type in Amoeba Sisters, and this is the enzymes video. It's about 5 minutes. We're probably going to stop it a little short of 5 minutes. Make sure we got sound.
Favorite protein? Well, I don't think so. Probably because my favorite protein happens to remind me of one of my favorite childhood games, Pac-Man. If you've ever played Pac-Man before, then chances are we're much, much older than you. But now you can play it on Google. Just Google Pac-Man. It's a Google Doodle. Anyway, I digress. But see, in Pac-Man, you have this little character. It goes around, finds these pebbles, and the pebbles fit right into it. Well, a lot of illustrations that you will find of enzymes, they happen to look, at least us, a lot like Pac-Man. I remember P for Pac-Man and P for protein. Most enzymes are proteins. Now, in the game, we mentioned that there are these little pebbles that Pac-Man goes after. Well, enzymes have a specifically shaped area called an active site, where items combined, the items are called substrates. It's very specific binding because the active site is specifically shaped for the substrate that binds there. Very specific. So what happens when a substrate binds an enzyme? Well, usually the substrate is held there with some weak bonds because it's not going to stay there forever. Something called induced fit will happen, which means the active site can change its shape even more to bind that substrate, like an enzyme substrate hug. The enzyme can either build up or break down the substrates that specifically bind to it, and we call the resulting item the product. An enzyme has the ability to really speed up reactions. Reactions that technically could happen on their own, but with the help of enzymes, they can be sped up to make processes effective for life. Let me give you a great real-life example. The enzyme lactase. Another really cool thing about enzymes is that they often end in ASE, like lactase. Many sugars, on the other hand, end in OSE, and lactose is an example of a sugar. Lactose is a disaccharide, meaning it contains two sugar molecules bound together. We don't actually digest it so well in that form. It's big. The enzyme lactase has the ability to break lactose down into smaller parts that our body can digest. And this is a lot better option than waiting for a chemical reaction with lactose to happen spontaneously. Now, with the lactase enzyme, lactose can be broken down quickly and digested. Now, there are some people that do not produce enough lactase. They can be what we call lactose intolerant, which means that if they consume foods that have lactose, such as milk, it can make them sick. They can't break the lactose down efficiently without lactase. In that example, one thing to point out, lactase, the enzyme, can break down a lot of lactose, the substrate. The lactase doesn't get used up in the reaction. It's still there. We call enzymes a catalyst because they can be used over and over and over and over in the reaction. By the way, your digestive system uses all kinds of enzymes. You have lipase, and that breaks down lipids, which are fats. You have amylase, which breaks down starch. You have protease, which breaks down proteins. So, as you can see, the digestive system is very involved with enzymes. Another thing to point out is that enzymes don't always work alone. Sometimes they get some help. Some often underappreciated but essential little helpers are called cofactors and coenzymes. They may bind to the substrate or to the active site. They help the enzyme do its job of building up or breaking down substrates into products. Now, you didn't forget our Pac-Man analogy yet, right? In the game Pac-Man, there are these ghosts. And when they touch the Pac-Man, it makes this sound. It's like... And the Pac-Man shape gets all distorted in the process. So what does this have to do with enzymes? No, there aren't ghosts around, but enzymes do have certain ideal conditions that they like. For example, an enzyme that is in your stomach would have an ideal pH that is very acidic because the environment in your stomach is very acidic. Different enzymes have different ideal pH and temperature ranges. If an environment changes out of an enzyme's ideal pH or temperature range, then something that reminds me a lot of that horrible sound I'm trying to make can happen. The enzyme becomes denatured. That means its shape becomes distorted. It can no longer bind to its substrate. It can no longer work correctly. It is finished. Well, that's a dramatic end to enzymes. Keep in mind that if you have an interest in this topic, many medical researchers have a large focus on enzymes. Enzymes regulate a lot of the body processes, and many diseases can involve specific enzyme production or the lack of it. Well, that's it for the
Sisters. Okay. So thanks to them, we covered enzymes. Let's hit your worksheet, Ben. Okay, so enzymes and substrates come together at an area called what? Active site, good. And the active site is specific between an enzyme and its substrate. We really can't use enzymes on other substrates for that reason. Notice the term down there, activation energy. So how do enzymes help out with the chemical reactions they participate in? They speed it up, they lower that activation energy. Good. So we call them in this video here catalyst because they help make our reactions run more quickly. All right, let me get you rehooked up. There we are, okay. Okay, so down there near the bottom, you'll notice a term called denaturation. That's what we were talking about in terms of if you change the shape of that enzyme, it can no longer work properly. What are some factors that will influence an enzyme shape? Could be the location. Because what kinds of environments are hostile to enzymes? Acidic, yeah. And what else? Heat, right. So you'll notice there are factors that influence enzyme activity. Enzymes don't care for acids, and they also don't care for heat. So I'm going to take a side trip for just a moment. If you do any kind of chemical treatment to your hair, then oftentimes it is an acid-based solution, and that acid-based solution can either cause bonds in your hair to break and become straight, or it can make straight hair become curly. So it's interesting that proteins and enzymes have the same issue with acids. Acids can change the shape of a protein or an enzyme. If you pickle eggs, I don't know if you like that or not, but pickled eggs are in vinegar, and so vinegar is an acid, and that takes a raw egg into what looks like a cooked egg shape. So there's another example of how acids can denature a protein. And then, what it is scary. What else?
It's just gross.
It is gross. And, I mean, you know, you
it
think
it cooks it, right?
It kind of cooks it, yeah. Just like if you put anything acidic on meat and let it sit there for a while, it kind of transforms the meat into a cooked steak.
Is that why, like, ceviche, why the lime juice kind of cooks the fish?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's raw, but it's rubbery.
That doesn't sound
good. No, it does not. heat's probably a better way to change protein shape or enzyme shape. High heat, like cooking proteins, will change the shape and make it a different structure. In our bodies, what happens when you have a fever?
We don't digest food so hot.
Yeah, you don't digest food so hot. Your enzymes don't necessarily like the hot temperature. We can survive with high heat in our bodies, you know, 103, 104, but we will die if it's internally 108. So enzymes just say, look, I've had it. That's just too hot for me to function when you get that warm. On your picture down below, here's once again that lactase-lactose reaction. Is lactase your substrate or your enzyme? It is your enzyme. How do you know?
ASE.
Good. Lactase is your enzyme. What about lactose? Substrate. Good. And do you recognize that O-S-E ending?
Sugar.
Good. So in fact, it is a substrate, and you're right. O-S-E says I'm a sugar. The middle picture shows where the two, the enzyme and the substrate, join together. That is our active site. And finally, we produce two what? Two products. Good. All right, so lactase is our enzyme, lactose is the substrate. The middle picture, they join at the active site, they produce two products. This looks like we are breaking down, so is it catabolic or anabolic in nature?
Catabolic,
good. How about questions on page 22 or 23? Let's talk nucleic acids. They will finish up the chapter for us. They are found on page 24. Nucleic acids are oftentimes not, you know, we don't see these on food labels, obviously, but nucleic acids are important for our bodies because they help us build our DNA, our RNA, and our ATP. The building block or monomer for this category is called a nucleotide. That's easy to remember, right? Nucleic, nucleotide kind of sound the same. You will want to know the three components. They are a phosphate group, sugar, and a base that contains nitrogen. So we call it a nitrogenous base. Okay, so you'll want to know the three components of a typical nucleotide: phosphate, sugar, and a base. The function of this category, well, most of these molecules are in the job of being a genetic component, like a DNA or RNA. You may wonder why ATP is here in this category, and that's because it's got the same nucleotide structure. So you say, well, hey, wait a minute, ATP, what is the job of ATP?
Energy.
And you say, well, the other two examples here, DNA and RNA, they have a job of being genetic components, like carrying the blueprint for your cells. But, you know, you say, why does ATP go in this category? It's all to do with the fact that it's built from nucleotides. So let me show you what DNA looks like. We'll tackle that one first. DNA is a double-stranded molecule. It is made up of two strands of repetitive nucleotides. So what were the three components of a typical nucleotide? Good. Phosphate, sugar, and a base. P is your phosphate. S is your sugar, and there's your bases. There are color blocks running up the middle of this, what looks to be a ladder. So you'll notice that the phosphate, the sugar, and the base, that makes up one nucleotide. The phosphate and the sugar, all the way up this ladder are the exact same. And in DNA, the sugar is called deoxyribose. And how do you know it's a sugar?
OSE.
Well, since the phosphates and the sugars are identical, we kind of need a way to be able to tell apart one nucleotide from another. So what we do is we look at the base and we say, oh, this nucleotide has the base cytosine, or C, and so that's what we call this nucleotide. We actually call the nucleotide based on its base. This nucleotide here has G. That base stands for? Guanine, right. The next one has a phosphate, a sugar, and a T for the base. That base T is
thymine.
And A, of course, adenine. Good. So, you know, because nucleotides have all the same sugar, all the same phosphate groups, we simply name them based on their nitrogenous base. Okay, so how do these base pairs work? What does cytosine tend to pair with?
Guanine.
Cytosine tends to pair with guanine. So C's and G's, G's and C's go together. What does T or thymine tend to pair with?
Adenine.
Good, so A's and T's and A's pair together. Hey, if you can keep those four letters straight and who pairs with who, adenine and thymine, cytosine and guanine, then you've got quite a bit of this taken care of, because that's going to be the basis for where we go. So, in fact, DNA does not exist like this ladder that you see on the left. It twists itself up in what looks to be a spiral staircase, and the reason for that is where it's stored. Where is DNA stored? In the nucleus. Can you see the nucleus with your bare eye? So all of your genetic information is stored in something that you can't even see. And it's obviously a space issue. So that's why this DNA is twisted up in what we call a double helix. It is twisted so it can be tightly packed and stored into the nucleus. Well, RNA is going to be something we talk about today as well. We're going to come back to it when we talk about protein synthesis. RNA is actually just a copy of your DNA. And when a copy is made, we flip out one of our bases. Which base is not found in RNA?
Thymine.
What do we replace it with?
Uracil.
Good. So you still have adenine, guanine, and cytosine here. We just don't have the T's or the thymine. So we'll come back to RNA in a few minutes. You'll notice that RNA is also single-stranded. DNA is double-stranded. DNA is housed in your nucleus. RNA can actually leave your nucleus. Again, something we'll talk about over here on the board in just a few minutes. Our last type of nucleic acid is adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. What is the function of ATP?
Energy.
Good. Do you know the organelle that makes ATP? Mitochondria, good. And what types of ingredients or reactants do you need to make ATP?
Sugar
and
oxygen.
Yeah, you gotta eat, you gotta breathe. Okay, so you got to have your glucose and your oxygen to make ATPs. So the A in ATP is the nitrogenous base. It is adenine here. The TP is triphosphate. How many phosphates are here? There's three. Okay, so ATP is actually adenine, three phosphates, and by the way, the sugar is the same as RNA sugar. What is that sugar? Ribose, right. Of our nucleic acids, which one contains deoxyribose? DNA, good. So we'll come back to ATP when we talk about muscles and how they work. So we'll save most of our conversation for a little later. We're actually going to focus on DNA and RNA here in just a moment. All right, so 24, that page wraps up this chapter. Is there anything I can address again or answer for you on that page? Okay, page 25 is just a worksheet that actually gives you a good basis for flashcards if you like to learn that way. Page 26 is a practice page with answers at the very bottom, and same thing with 27. All right, so we're switching gears. We're heading into chapter 3. We're going into cell territory now. And what I'd like to show you is the scale of the size that we're working on right now. This website is at the University of Utah. It's called learn.genetics. It is a great website. They got a lot of cool stuff up there for you to play with, including this thing. So, you know, if you've ever seen a coffee bean or a grain of rice, you can see that with the naked eye. You can see Times New Roman or Times Regular here. That's 12 font. That's big to us right now. You can barely see the sesame seed in this picture, and we're going to just continue scrolling in so you can see the size of what we're dealing with. So as we scroll in, a grain of salt and then an amoeba becomes visible. And right now, we're dealing with cells that are barely visible to your naked eye. You can actually see a human egg with the naked eye. It's very hard to see because it's very tiny. It fits on the tip of a pinhead. So, in fact, it is the largest cell in the human body. It has to be because it carries all the goods for a future baby. And it floats in a female's uterus for about 7 days before it ever finds a home inside the uterus lining. So it has to be a big cell. It comes packed for a 7-day trip. You can also see paramecium there. You can see some other small stuff in the background. That other tiny stuff is not visible with the naked eye. It requires a microscope. There's a skin cell. This photoreceptor cell is found in your eye, not visible to the naked eye. The smallest cell in the human body is the sperm. Oddly enough, combines with the largest cell in the human body. And then we're going to zoom in, and you've got a red blood cell, some chromosomes. There's some organelles, mitochondria and lysosome. Nasty old E. coli is actually on the size scale of your organelles. That's incredibly small. More little tiny things coming into focus. You're now getting the viruses to show up. There's measles, HIV, and the flu virus. Boy, tiny stuff, right? There is hemoglobin. You know, and we talked about that being a big protein. But big's relative, right? Because compared to everything else, that's incredibly small. Keep on coming in. We just talked about adenine. There's glucose, water molecules, and barely visible there in the background, there's a carbon atom. So when we're talking about small stuff, you can see in terms of relation just what we're looking at here, just how small these things are. So today, we're going to work on DNA, RNA. We're going to work on, you know, molecules that are on this scale size here, like nanometers in terms of size. So a pretty cool website. We'll just zoom back out. Okay, so let's talk about the three structures that you typically see in any eukaryotic cell. And what are those three structures? Okay. Okay, so you've got three things that are common to most of our eukaryotic cells. They are the plasma membrane, the cytoplasm at the very bottom, and over on 29, the nucleus. So if you were to take a cheek cell swab, this is what you would see. You would actually see those three components. You did that. Good, good. So that plasma membrane around the outside is your boundary. All the semi-fluid medium inside your what? Cytoplasm, good. And this structure in the center?
Nucleus.
And these things here you probably didn't get a chance to see because of our microscope powers, but do you know what they are? Bacteria. Ickies, yeah. The dirty stuff in your mouth, right? So these things that look like sprinkles on a cupcake are not. They are
yummy.
Yeah. They're the reason we brush our teeth. So yeah, those bacteria show up in this picture. You probably saw something looking more like this. Okay, so like I said, there's three things that make up most of our cells: cytoplasm, plasma membrane, and nucleus. We're going to start off by talking about the plasma membrane first. Structurally, we're going to take a trip back in time. You'll find two layers of phospholipids forming your plasma membranes. That's your blank. Two layers of phospholipids. Okay, that's the top of 28. Do you recall why the phospholipid has a straight chain and a bent chain? The straight chain has no double bonds. Is it saturated or unsaturated?
Saturated.
It's saturated. This bent chain has a double bond right there. It's in fact unsaturated. Yeah, so these phospholipids have two chains, two fatty acid chains, one saturated, one unsaturated. And they also have a head region that happens to be polar in nature. How do polar objects get along with water? They like each other, right. How do the tails, which are hydrophobic, behave around water? They don't like water. So when we look at this phospholipid bilayer, you'll notice those heads that love water are oriented out so they can contact water. All of these are phospholipid heads. And on the interior surface, all of these are phospholipid heads. So the heads love water. They are not at all having any trouble contacting water. Notice the tails. They're hiding on the inside because they hate water. And the fancy word for that is what?
Hydrophobic.
Good. Heads are lovers. They're hydrophilic. The tails are haters. They're hydrophobic. So, you know, they're hiding on the inside of the membrane like, oh gosh, don't let water come through here. We just hate water. So they hang out on the inside where they're less likely to contact water. Some people describe the plasma membrane like a sandwich. If you use your imagination, you can probably see the two layers of bread are made by your phospholipid heads. And then the meat of your sandwich on the inside is made by those phospholipid tails. And if you've got a really big sandwich, take a toothpick and stab all the way through. That's one of these things here. That's a protein that sticks all the way through your phospholipid bilayer. So let's talk about those proteins for just a moment. Some proteins travel all the way through your phospholipids, like this one. It's called an integral protein. So it's like taking a toothpick and stabbing your sandwich all the way through. Other proteins are found only on one surface. So it's kind of like laying a pickle on the top of your sandwich. Not inside, but just on top of your sandwich. And these are called peripheral proteins. So peripheral proteins are on the periphery or on the outside. They don't travel all the way through your membranes. So these proteins that you see sticking off the outer surface of your membrane, they serve to function as recognition proteins, which means you've got white blood cells sniffing you out all the time. Believe it or not, they are checking you out. They check out your cells and they look for those recognition peripheral proteins. And if the white blood cells say, yep, you look like me, you smell like me, you probably are me, I'm gonna leave you alone. They keep on traveling past. But if they find a cell that has proteins that don't recognize, those white blood cells go on the attack and they destroy that cell. So that's why these proteins are important. They help our bodies recognize what is part of ourselves. Receptor proteins bind molecules that come and dock here on these cells. Carrier and channel proteins are these integral ones. We'll talk about more when we discuss osmosis and diffusion in a bit. And then there's an outer structure called the glycocalyx, which is mostly composed of carbs on the outer surface. So all of this stuff on the outside of your cell contains peripheral proteins, it contains carbs, some lipids. This outer portion is called the glycocalyx. What does that glyco prefix say to you? Sugar. So this outer surface has a lot of stuff sticking off of it that makes it sticky. So things stick to the outer surface that passes by your cell. So it is sugary sweet, it is sticky, and that's intentional. We want things to be able to stick to our cells. We want them to stick to each other. So if you've ever heard of tissue typing for organ transplants, and they'll say, hey, these two people, you know, you've got a family member, this is not a good match. And that's because they're looking at these surface features. If you do find somebody who's a good organ match, then your surface features look very similar. And it's quite likely that a family member would be a good match for somebody. But you know, when they're looking at the glycocalyx, they're looking at carbs and proteins out there, they're looking to see if you and someone else have a similar match to less likely reject that transplanted organ. All right, so down below on that picture of the cell, can you recognize letters A, B, C, D, and E? All right, so let's start with letter A. How would you name that outer sticky surface? It's carb chains, and you could say, in fact, that includes also the glycocalyx because that's the outside of your cell. So A could be your carb chain. It could be a glycocalyx region. B are your phospholipid what?
Heads.
Good. And C, your tails. Good. So B, your phospholipid heads. C, the tails. D is a... It is an integral protein. And you know it's integral because... Goes straight through. Good. So D is integral protein and E is peripheral. Good. So E is peripheral. It sits on the outside. Very bottom of your page, just a tad bit of info there about your cytoplasm. I think probably the best way to visualize cytoplasm is to think of it as a semi-fluid medium, kind of like Jell-O is. Not quite solid, not quite liquid, but it does hold the organelles inside your cells in place. It does contain fluid. What is that fluid called?
Intracellular.
Good. Intracellular fluid. And cytosol is sometimes another name given to that liquid portion of your cytoplasm. There are solutes in here. It does have a slightly salty concentration. And there are organelles held in place by these cytoplasm, you know, structures. So think of it kind of like a semi-fluid like Jell-O. Maybe fruit cocktail embedded in it would be your organelles. Let me flip you over to page 29. Let's talk about the nucleus there. What's that? Yeah, we will sometimes hit, sometimes miss what y'all are doing in lab. We try to stay more or less at the same pace, but it doesn't always work. So cells, most cells, not every cell, but most cells have a brain, and that brain is called the nucleus. It is the genetic control center of your cell. And we're going to start by looking specifically at the nucleus structure. So I might describe the nucleus as a wiffle ball. And if you've never seen a wiffle ball, it's just a hollow plastic ball. It has these holes all over it. And you might not think that that's a great storage location for your DNA. Why does that sound like it might be a poor place to store your DNA? It might fall out. What else? Anything could get in it. Yeah, stuff could get out, stuff could get in. I mean, it doesn't look like a very safe place to store your very important blueprint, which is your DNA. So there's actually a reason for these holes all over your nucleus. Those pores are there to let information out. So if you lock the DNA away inside a airtight, watertight space, there's no way to communicate with the nucleus. So it's a risk to have these pores here, but the risk is that we need information to actually escape from your nucleus through those pores. So inside the nucleus, this nuclear envelope provides the boundary. It is studded with these holes or pores. Inside we have fluid called nucleoplasm. That sounds familiar, right? Nucleoplasm sounds like cytoplasm. So it's like a fluid inside your nucleus. And it comes and goes by way of those pores. We have a spot there, it's called the nucleolus. It's kind of like the house party inside your nucleus. It's where most of the DNA and proteins hang out. So it appears as a dark spot inside the nucleus. And then scattered throughout the rest of the nucleoplasm here is stuff called chromatin. And chromatin is kind of like DNA that's just hanging out, doing its thing, and it looks like unraveled yarn. Okay, so it's not DNA of any structure. It's just like you found somebody at home, they're in their underwear hanging out, and you're embarrassed you rang your doorbell, right? Okay, so that's what DNA is chromatin. It's just hanging out. It's not really structured. It's just hanging out inside the nucleus. Okay, so I want to make a point here. When we say the word nucleus, we mean the envelope, its pores, the chromatin, the nucleolus, the nucleoplasm. It is the whole kit and caboodle. It's everything. So nucleus really means all of the stuff you see in this picture. Okay, so just as a reminder, DNA structure is next. DNA is composed of building blocks. What are those building blocks called? Nucleotides. And nucleotides have three components. The sugar here is deoxyribose. So number one's blank is sugar. Number one's blank is sugar. The sugar in DNA is called deoxyribose. Number two's blank is phosphate group. Number two's blank is phosphate group. Okay, and number three, one of four bases. Do you remember what those four are? Good. Adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine. Or you can just put A, T, C, and G, right? Makes it simple. Okay, so we're going to talk about chromatin and chromosomes for just a moment. When DNA is relaxed inside your cell, it is in a state that we call chromatin. And chromatin, like I mentioned, looks kind of like unraveled yarn. It's just hanging out. It's not in any particular structure. When we need your DNA to divide or produce proteins, mostly to divide through mitosis and meiosis, we're looking for DNA to be in a more structured shape, and we call this a chromosome. In fact, these are both chromosomes. This one looks like a single airplane propeller, and we call it a single-stranded chromosome. Guess what this one's called? Double-stranded chromosome. So all of this is DNA. It just takes on different states depending on what time of the day it is for your cell. If your cell's relaxing, chromatin is inside the nucleus. Otherwise, if we're doing something like replication or cell division, then we're going to find DNA in a more structured look, which is a chromosome. All right, so the nucleus there, the function in the middle of your page, the function of your nucleus is to house the DNA. Like I mentioned earlier, the DNA is twisted up into a double helix, kind of looks like a spiral staircase. And the whole goal here is to package that DNA into a very tight, small space. We've got 23 pairs of chromosomes packed into our nucleus. 23 pairs is actually how many chromosomes total? 46, yeah. So imagine you got 46 of these things packed into the nucleus. It has to be organized in a very tightly condensed structure, thus this double helix that you see over here. Double helix means DNA has how many strands?
Two strands.
Two strands. And what are the base pairing rules that hold together those two strands? A's and T's go together, and C's and G's. Good. So if we want to replicate or copy our DNA, and we do that during mitosis or leading up to mitosis, we've got an issue, because if I use this zipper to represent DNA, it's not only zipped up, but it's twisted around in this double helix, just like you see here. So it'd be very hard for me to copy this DNA when it's in this particular shape. The reason we have this shape is for space storage. We've got to twist it up, curl it up, get it really tiny and tight, and shove it into the nucleus. But when it's time to copy the DNA during cell division, we've got to untwist the DNA, and we have to unzip the DNA. So we actually have to get the shape a little bit differently arranged. So that's what I'd like to talk to you about now is DNA replication. That's down there on the bottom of your page. So have you guys done mitosis in lab yet?
We're working on it now.
Okay, so are you familiar with the cell cycle? Okay. Let's just do a refresher. The cell cycle is basically a life cycle for a cell, and the cell cycle goes through these phases. Mitosis is cell division. That's when the cell divides in half and makes a new cell. The rest of this cycle is a large portion, in fact, it's 90% of your cell's lifetime, and that's interphase. Now, I don't mean to imply that we only have cells go through mitosis once. They'll cycle through mitosis. It takes about 24 hours, and then they'll spend a few weeks going through interphase. They'll cycle back through mitosis again. Your cell may live for a few weeks, maybe for a few months, and it will rotate through this cycle maybe several times. And at some point, your cell's worn out and it will die. So we're gonna focus right now not on mitosis. I know you're working on that in lab. We're gonna focus instead on this big portion of interphase called synthesis, or S phase. So G1, S, and G2, all of that is part of what phase? Interphase, right. Not the cell division portion, but all of this is just regular lifetime, you know, just doing your day-to-day activities. If you think about it with a human being, you know, if a woman has two or three babies in her lifetime, that's two or three mitosis events, right? And the rest of her life, she's not making babies. The rest of her life, she's going through interphase. So it's kind of how we operate in terms of, you know, we don't spend 90 years of a 90-year lifespan having babies. It's only a small portion of that time period. Okay, so we are in S phase. We know what's coming. We're going clockwise. We know coming around the bend here is mitosis, and the cell must divide. When cells divide, they take their chromosomes and they split them in half. So we have to make sure that we take a single-stranded chromosome and copy it, because each cell needs its own DNA. It's going to pop this thing in half right there at the purple dot in the middle. So the way we make extra DNA in synthesis phase in preparation for mitosis is, well, we got to untwist our DNA first, okay? got to make it straight, and then we've also got to unzip the DNA, because what holds together these two rungs?
All those base pairs.
All those base pairs, right. So if you look at this picture here, we've actually untwisted, unzipped the DNA, and that allows for these base pairs to be exposed, kind of like what you see here. So if you keep in mind your base pairing rules, A's and T's pair together, C's and G's pair together, that makes DNA replication really easy. So what I did for you down here is I untwisted and unzipped the DNA. We're going to take the two parent strands and open them up. And all we're going to do now is create daughter strands. We're going to do base pairing rules with these parent strands. All right, so here we haven't quite yet unzipped. So let's start on the top row. C's pair with what?
G's.
G's. And A pairs with T. C, A, T,
G, C, A.
A there, and T there. Okay, so what we just did was we brought in the appropriate base pairs, and this whole thing is called the daughter strand. I mean, this feels like a no-brainer, right? Okay, hopefully. Okay, you got a built-in self-check because these base pairs you just created should look just like the old parent strand. Okay, so you've got a built-in way to check and make sure you did it correctly. This parent strand is going to be the template for this one here.
G.
C. What's the A's parent? T.
A.
And we'll put an A there. Okay, so you may get another daughter strand right there. Okay, that daughter strand should look just like the other parent strand because, you know, we're just making copies here. If you make an accident or you don't do base pairing correctly, it's called a mutation. And sometimes those mutations are inherited, sometimes they're harmless. But nonetheless, there are enzymes that come along and check to make sure that we did the base pairing. I wish you had one of those on test day, right? So you just have to make sure you do the A's and the T's and the C's and the G's correctly. Eventually, what you're going to do is you're going to have parent strand, daughter strand. Here's old parent strand. Here's daughter strand. And then we've got parent and daughter. Parent and daughter. Ooh, what does that look like?
Chromosome.
Looks like a chromosome. So this here is just a tiny piece of what you're doing in the whole chromosome. And this thing lines up on the metaphase plate. And what happens to it during metaphase?
Pull apart,
right. So this portion goes to this cell, that portion goes to that cell. And does each cell get the exact same type of DNA?
Mm-hmm.
Same exact. Right, so this cell gets exactly the same DNA that this cell is getting. That's why you can look at these two strands and say, yep, they're identical to these two strands. So we're, you know, pretty certain that we're giving away the same DNA that the other cell is going to be keeping. Do you think you could do base pairing come test day? A's, T's, C's, and G's? Okay. Let's see, I'll leave you practice one. I did leave you a practice one if you would like to try it down there at the very bottom. Bottom of page 29, yeah.
So to answer that last question about the daughter.
Let's see, it contains, each one has a parent and a daughter.
Parent and a daughter, okay.
Yeah, parent and a daughter, what's that? Okay, so let me just read off for you. You've got a parent strand that starts off A, T, C, A, T, G. the daughter that you should be writing right underneath it should look like T-A-G, T-A-C. I figure if you got that far, you're probably good. And then there's a daughter strand again to write for the very bottom parent strand. The parent strand says T-A-G, T-A-C. What should the daughter strand look like? Let's see, it should say A-T-C, A-T-G. You good so far? Okay. The commonly missed thing here is people confuse uracil for thymine, because we're getting ready to do uracil over here. So I just want to remind you to not get the U's in the mix when you're doing DNA replication. There's only thymines or T's here. Let's talk about protein synthesis. It's on the top of page 30. So here's the deal. This huge thing is a nucleus, and we've got our DNA inside the nucleus. We'll put it up there. The DNA is really special. It's our blueprint for life, and we don't want the DNA to leave the nucleus. But what we do want to do is make proteins out here in the cytoplasm. Unfortunately, we can't take the DNA out there to make those proteins, but we can take a copy, and the copy is our RNA molecule. So you'll notice that RNA is single-stranded. DNA is what? It's double-stranded. You'll also notice another difference here. RNA contains a different sugar. It's called ribose. DNA sugar is called deoxy. Yeah, ribose. And one more difference is, of course, uracil. Uracil replaces which base? Thymine. Good. Okay, so in order to make DNA into RNA, we have to go through two steps. We have to go through transcription first to rewrite the DNA into the RNA. And then we take the RNA and translate it through the second step. That's translation. I'm going to talk about three types of RNA here in just a moment. I'm going to actually raise the screen, but I do want to tell you, this PowerPoint has the steps to transcription and the steps to translation. So if you want to pull this PowerPoint, it's on the D2L site. It's under the content area. Just look for my PowerPoints from class, and those you can pull off there. Okay. Okay. So let me give you perspective of where we're at. We're in the G phases of interference. This is the time of the life, for the time of the cell's life, where it's just growing, it's doing its day-to-day activities, it's making proteins. We are not undergoing mitosis. That's not really the plan right now. We're just living day-to-day in our cell. So the cell needs to make proteins, and it comes to a piece of this DNA that says, right about here, this codes for making some new enzymes. Enzymes are proteins, right? Okay, so we're not going to use the whole piece of DNA. We're just going to use the specific portion that codes for making our enzyme. So I'm going to give you a piece of that DNA. Okay, and that's my strand of DNA that codes for the enzyme. The first thing we have to do is make that strand of DNA into a strand of RNA. Keep in mind, RNA can leave these nuclear pores, come out to the cytoplasm. You know, so what if it gets damaged? If you kill the photocopy, you still have the original, the blueprint inside your cell. So that's why we let the RNA leave the cell and not the DNA, or the nucleus, rather. All right, so here's the catch. When we do transcription, remember that we're going to replace T's with U's. And what I mean by that is A is A-OK.
No.
Right?
A is OK.
A is OK.
A is
left.
U.
Should I put a T there?
No. Oh,
put a U.
I got to put a U there.
U.
OK, so A is OK. Replace those T's with U. Thank goodness C's and G's work just like normal, right? There's my G, another G, C, U, U, A is okay. Okay. So I just made a copy. It's called RNA. Let's take that RNA, right here's a nuclear pore. Let's take it out through that nuclear pore, and we're going to head over to a ribosome or the rough ER. Why are we heading into those two organelles? They make proteins. Good, good. So when we do translation, I'll see if I can write closer here. I don't know why that thing, whoops, why this thing won't go back up. Okay, so I'm going to rewrite this over here. All I did was I took my RNA out of the nucleus. Remember, it's a photocopy. We're just going to make a protein based on what this code says. And we're going to bring it out here into the cytoplasm to the ribosomes. Ribosomes can be found free, or they can be found attached to a rough ER. And I promise you, they look like a hamburger bun. Okay? So hamburger buns have a big piece on top and a small piece on the bottom. These are the ribosome components. And we call them rRNA. Okay? And by the way, what we just made, that RNA is a specific type. It carries a code. It's the messenger RNA. So nowadays in the grocery store, if you go in and you look for a price on a product, you can go to a price scanner and it will tell you this product is $1.99. That's what we need right now, because if I look at this, I have no idea what the code says for this mRNA strand. So you and I are going to play like we're the price scanner. If you've got your course pack handy, at the bottom of page 30 are a bunch of codes. You do not have to memorize the codes. I'm going to give you one of these on the test. All you have to do is say, well, codes come in groups of threes. They are called codons. So AUG, that code or codon, should be what? Yeah, it should be start, and its fancy name is like thymine. Let's see, how many go in a code?
Three.
Three, and they're called what?
Codons.
Codons. GCG. Let's read that code. I'm finding alanine on the very bottom row. Okay. Everybody find it? Okay. My next group of three is another code or codon. It's called GUU. Let's find that one.
Valine.
Everybody see valine or valine at the very bottom? And you probably are a step ahead of me. You have probably already found UAA means what?
Stop.
It means stop. So what we just did is called translation. You and I were translating using this codon chart, and the reason we had to have it is we can't read this code without the scanner, and that's what these are. These are scanners for us. tRNA, that's what we were doing. We were playing the role of tRNA. We were transferring the right amino acid based on what that code says. So it comes along like a little three-prong reader. It goes AUG, that is star of thymine, GCG, that's alanine, and it just keeps joining together these amino acids. These amino acids make a protein. They always have a start and a stop. If you don't have a start and a stop, you didn't do it right. Let me give you one last hint before you leave today. Transcription, trans, is the first portion of each word, but there's a C, and that comes before L alphabetically, so transcription comes before translation. And my second clue for you, there's an R, because transcription makes RNA. There's an A, translation makes amino acids. Okay. Okay, so a couple of helpful hints there. There are some practice problems in my PowerPoint. We will start with those on Tuesday. If you would read ahead on organelles, what I'm going to do Tuesday is review this stuff with you, and then we're going to talk about membrane transport on page 35.